So the Lord be with you. The prayer I want to offer today is one that I want to read to you. So listen up. O cosmic birther of all radiance and vibration, soften the ground of our being and carve out a space within us where your presence can abide. Fill us with your creativity so that we may be empowered to bear the fruit of your mission. Let each of our actions bear fruit in accordance with your desire. Endow us with the wisdom to produce and share what each being needs to grow and flourish. Untie the tangled threads of destiny that bind us as we release others from the entanglement of past mistakes. Do not let us be seduced by that which would divert us from our true purpose, but illuminate the opportunities of the present moment. For you are the ground and the fruitful vision, the birth power and fulfillment as all is gathered and made whole again. Isn't that beautiful? It will be in the summary that goes out. That is a paraphrase translation of what is usually called the Lord's Prayer, and it is the work of a renowned biblical scholar, religious studies scholar, spirituality scholar, psychology scholar, Neil Douglas Klotz. I have read, I think, everything he has done. Two of the first books that I read of his are Prayers of the Cosmos, about which Matthew Fox wrote, "Reader, beware. Though this book be brief, it contains the seeds of revolution." And the other that I would recommend is a book called The Hidden Gospel, Decoding the Spiritual Message of the Aramaic Jesus. Now, these were the first books that I read in the wave of new Jesus scholarship that began after the publication of the Dead Sea Scrolls. These books were written well before 9/11, and I spent 2 years studying the works of Neil Douglas Klotz in an effort to prepare myself to do a series in here, which I did years ago, on the Lord's Prayer. So I'm going to read this prayer to you again, just to let it soak in. O cosmic birther of all radiance and vibration. And Klotz is working with the Aramaic language, and like Hebrew, each word paints a picture. It's not like the language that we are used to use, certainly nothing like Greek. Soften the ground of our being and carve out a space within us where your presence can abide. Fill us with your creativity so that we may be empowered to bear the fruit of your mission. Let each of our actions bear fruit in accordance with your desire. Endow us with the wisdom to produce and share what each being needs to grow and flourish. Untie the tangled threads of destiny that bind us as we release others from the entanglement of past mistakes. Do not let us be seduced by that which would divert us from our true purpose, but illuminate the opportunities of the present moment, for you are the ground and the fruitful vision, the birth power and fulfillment, as all is gathered and made whole once again. I read that prayer in the part of the section of writings that I look at every day as part of my spiritual practice, which we're going to talk about today, because I fear I've never mentioned it to you before. The title I've given this talk today is Sacred Space. And I have been influenced to move in the direction of talking about this by the passage that we are up to in going through one version of the Jesus story. This one is edited by scholars in the Jesus Seminar. And here's the passage. And by the way, I need to let you know, those of you who own this book that we're going through, and I encourage you to have it, we're nearing the end of the story. You know, in days before they had television and texting, people just told the story. They didn't do it like we're doing here. They just told the story. Let me tell you the story about Jesus. And they would tell a story. And at the end of the story, in most all of the scholarly works, the particular passage we're up to today has a section heading, and it's called In Jerusalem. And we're heading to the end. And you're about to hear the passage that, according to every teller of the Jesus story, was the thing that headed Jesus toward being executed. They came to Jerusalem, and he went into the temple and began chasing the vendors and shoppers out of the temple area, and he turned the bankers' tables upside down, along with the chairs of the pigeon merchants. Then he started teaching and would say to them, "Don't the scriptures say my house is to be regarded as a house of prayer for all peoples? But you have turned it into a hideout for crooks." Now, what the Jesus scholars are in agreement about is that Jesus had some kind of encounter in the temple. He opposed the way that the temple space was being used. Such an incident is mentioned 5 times in the gospel stories that we have. And yet the gospel writers are not able to say precisely what happened. Jesus began his teaching movement, and as he went about teaching, he and what he had to say grew in popularity. And he talked about a way of relating to sacred mystery that did everything from challenge to make fun of the power and authority of Rome. And as this went on, he drew the ire of both the religious and political leaders. Word of his teachings and deeds grew, as did his influence. His popularity among some, not everyone, grew, as did resistance against him. And then one day, they had enough. Now, the entire temple area was large enough to accommodate 34 football fields. It was big. And into that space on high holy days, that would be Passover, Pentecost, the Feast of Tabernacles, thousands of people would come, like the Muslims today go to Mecca or someplace. Pilgrimage was really very important. And included in that mix of pilgrims would be those who sold sacrificial animals, because sacrifice was a huge part of religion at that time. Also was the people who made the animals available for sale, because you didn't want to have to transport that all the way from your home. People who exchanged money and so that the pilgrims could buy what they needed. Then there would be the temple priest, and the temple police would also be there. And as the scholars point out, even if Jesus had walked over and turned over a table of money changers, he would have been arrested immediately by the police. But even if he had, it probably wouldn't have drawn that much attention. And the lines that Jesus uses in the quote are made up of a quote, a combined quote from Jeremiah and Isaiah. So it's very likely that somebody put that in the mouth of Jesus. You know, Jesus told stories and then his followers told stories about Jesus. What the scholars do agree on is that something was going on in the temple area that upset Jesus. He didn't like the way the space was being used. And he did something that not only brought attention to himself, but also irritated the people who were the Roman and priestly authorities. Of all the religions in the world, Christianity is the only one whose founder, though he didn't intend to found a religion, Christianity is the only one whose founder was executed. And every initial leader after Jesus of the Christian movement was also executed. And his followers attracted attention because of their joy and love for one another, the community that they created, the fearlessness with which they lived. And so those new to the movement would have wanted to know, why did this guy get killed? Why was he executed? And very likely the initial answer to that question would begin with something like, well, let me tell you what happened in the temple one day. And then they would tell the story. If we had a Skycam camera of that, you know how they do police stations now, we would not have seen much. The Romans got rid of people who bothered them easily, indiscriminately. It was like a cow flicking a fly off its body with its tail. Not that big a deal. The Romans executed a lot of people. At the time of Jesus, the worship was really focused on sacrifice. So that I've heard more than one Hebrew scholar say that at the time of Jesus and earlier, the primary function of a priest in the temple was to be a butcher because they slaughtered the animals for sacrifice. Now, these are not bad people any more than the religious and political leaders of our day are bad people, even though they have strayed from their original purpose. When Jesus saw it, however, through the lens he looked at the world with, from the bottom up and the outside in, from the powerless to the powerful, from inclusion to exclusion, from forgiveness to acceptance, and all the ways that Jesus had of seeing were ways that he said, this is the way God sees. This is the way that God would have the world run. There seemed to be something wrong with what was going on in the religion. It had just become accepted as business as usual. And the people who went there said things like, well, it's just the way things are. You can't fight City Hall. After all, you've got to be realistic. Talking about peace and justice in our time. I read a news story recently that absolutely blew me away. I'm going to read it to you in its entirety. And I don't know, but have you ever noticed that on television, when a religious or political leader says something that is just crazy? They're from Texas. Did you notice that? Yes. Megachurch, I'm quoting the newspaper here. Megachurch Bishop Ira V. Hilliard told his Sugar Land, Texas congregation that one of his two private aircraft, a helicopter valued at about $1 million, needs new rotor blades. But rather than pay it himself, he asks parishioners to each find it in their hearts to send him $52 favor seeds for the blades. His ministry also owns a $2 million Hawker jet and a $3 million hangar. And to sweeten the deal, he virtually promised that a donor's gift would be met by a breakthrough favor from God in the form of a car repair or their very own green car, either 52 days or 52 weeks later. I've got the link to this story in the summary that will go out. Hint. I would like an airplane. I don't know how to fly it, but I'd leave from there. He asked what I settled for a rotor blade. I went the whole thing. We just had Halloween. And I don't know about you, but in our neighborhood, some folks decorate as much for Halloween, if not more, than they do for Christmas. Here are a few pictures from the place where I live. I took these pictures while walking around with my dog. They have big sculptures, right? Big ghost. Ooh, this is my favorite. is really dangerous in the neighborhood. Even Spider-Man got caught. And this is no one you know. I would be willing to bet you that most people are not aware that Halloween is actually a corruption of the phrase All Hallows Eve. And it is means the day before the high holy day in the Christian calendar, which we celebrate today, but which was 2 days ago, which is All Saints Day. Great service across the plaza today. Now, in my own understanding of religion and spirituality, ritual plays a critically important role. Our everyday rituals that reflect civility and respect seem to be on the decline. You can tell that by driving. Especially important, I believe, are the rituals that are practiced in the various religions of the world that help people be centered, be focused, that remind us of our true identity, that remind us of our true purpose. I think the most memorable All Saints Day Sherry and I ever experienced just happened by luck. It was a number of years ago. We'd gone to Italy, and we were traveling like we like to do, with no reservations, meaning about where to stay. You know, that's what I mean. We'd spent time hiking the coast on the cities between what are called the Cinque Terre. We'd done a lot of hiking there. We'd gone to Florence. And so we decided we wanted to go to Assisi. And Sherry was driving the car. And I had a cell phone. Remember cell phones that you flipped open and could make a phone call? And so I was going through the guidebook calling hotels because I wanted to stay inside the walled city of Assisi. And every hotel I called, they said, "We're booked. We're booked. We're booked." But I'm a 5 on the Enneagram. I persist. So I persisted and got that one final call. The woman said, "No, we have no rooms." "Oh, wait a minute. I just had a cancellation. We have one room on the 6th floor for €300 a night." I said, "We'll take it." And Sherry said, "We can't afford that." And I had my little currency converter with me, and I put it in it, and I said, "Yes, we can." And it was not until we were on a boat going from Venice to Turkey, and I changed from euro to lira, that I realized I had put the currency conversion in my converter upside down. So we'd go out to dinner, and I would say, "Hey, this $25 bottle of wine is only $12.50. Oh, it was more like 50. Oh, well. So we got closer to Assisi, and the crowds got thicker. The traffic got thicker. The city, the wall city itself, was barricaded off, guarded by police. And I thought, what's going on here? Perhaps some political dignitary or media star. And we approached the barrier to get into the wall city. And the police said no. And I said, "We have a hotel reservation here." So they moved the barricade out of the way. And traffic was such that we had to park on the sidewalk in front of the hotel and get a hotel clerk to come park our car afterwards. And I thought, after we ditched ourselves in the room, let's go see the Basilica. So that's what I wanted to do. But we couldn't get to it. The crowds were so thick. And I really got irritated with the Italians. Why don't they just get out of here and let we tourists have the right to the space? We did other things. We hiked to the top of the city where we could look down on the Basilica. We went to all the other places where we could go. But every time that we approached here's the minister getting ready for his sermon, we suppose. I couldn't get in. We couldn't get in. And I was so unconscious of the fact that we had arrived on October the 30th. We explored the city on the 31st. Now, the 31st is not big in Italy for Halloween. But the next day is like a national holiday, All Saints Day. Everybody goes to church. So finally, on that All Saints Day, and I'm still absolutely unconscious of what's going on, I said to Sherry, we're going into that basilica if it hair-lips the governor. So like a flying wedge, we made our way into the basilica, only to have it dawn on me, we're here at High Mass at noon on All Saints Day at the Basilica of Francis. We found two seats in the middle of the cathedral and were transfixed by the service. They had a choir in residence. Sherry bought some CDs of the choir. Afterwards, I bought this little rosary of that St. Francis himself used. And a piece of the True Cross. I mean, we went down in the crypt. There were gold objects. There were artwork. The organ itself makes the one we have across in the cathedral here look pitiful. It was a magnificent, wonderful experience. And it was not until we left and we went back to the little church of San Dimano, where Francis knelt in front of this cross that would eventually carry his name. And this is that little church. It doesn't look like the basilica, does it? This is the inside of that church. Okay, where that cross is. And I wondered at the time what that man who took a vow of poverty would have thought about being in that basilica. It was in that little church. That's the real church, the little church that Francis knelt before that cross and heard God say, "Rebuild my church." Now the scholars, the Franciscan scholars, are in doubt whether, if God did say that, whether God meant rebuild the church or rebuild this particular building because it is falling down. The current Francis is getting good marks. Have you noticed that? There was an article in the news magazine I take and read that says, quote, Pope Francis has suspended a German bishop over his extravagant spending, including $42 million renovation of his residence, Franz Peter Turbatz von Elst, known as the Bishop of Bling, has been barred for now from his Limburg diocese. German Catholics were outraged at the bills for the renovation, such as $474,000 for built-in cabinets and $20,000 for a single bathtub, as well as reports that the bishop lied about traveling first class to India to visit the slums of Bangalore. Hundreds of Catholics in Limburg have officially severed ties with the church over the scandal. The Pope's sharp rebuke is just the latest example of his emphasis on austerity. Pope Francis drives a used car and has urged bishops to go out among the poor. So I got this conflict. Maybe you can help me resolve it. I had a transcendent spiritual experience in the Basilica of St. Francis. No doubt about it. I frequently do in this place across the plaza, and it ain't poor. I don't think Jesus was criticizing the overwhelming opulence of the temple. That's not to say that he was not a champion of those on the bottom and those without power. I think his message was something like, you are not seeing this space for what it is. And consequently, not only are you misusing it, but also you are not being who you are intended to be. One of the questions that I get on a regular basis, and it's one I ask myself, is how does transformation happen? Because I say that's one of the things that one of the four things that I keep thinking about, transformation. And my answer to that is with difficulty. Recently, I had to upgrade the operating system on my computer. I've never had a root canal. But at an emotional and certainly at a practical and convenience level, that's about what it feels like to me. like every other person in this room almost, I've gotten very dependent on my devices. I rely on them for all sorts of things. And so, as a matter of fact, I write these talks on that device right there with a wireless keyboard. And so I get this message from the Apple people that says, you have a free upgrade to your operating system. And I said, free? Boy, come on, I'll take it. I can write something on my device and it gets sent to God and then comes down here. They say it's the cloud, but I know better. Seriously, it is a pain to upgrade your operating system. I had to buy two big new memory sticks, which I don't know how to put in the computer. I have to wait till somebody can come and do that. That costs money. I wish I could buy something like that for here. I have applications and programs that don't work anymore. I have to find others. I have versions, old versions of applications that have so dramatically changed that I have to like go back to school to learn how to use them again. And here's the thing. I am sure that it will all eventually be okay. Right? I get used to it. And then I get lulled back into, oh, this is so good. And then it will happen all over again. Mm-hmm. Someone, we drop back into an operating system that becomes useless if we're not careful. That's what I'm saying. Someone recently sent me a cartoon that shows a man on his knees praying, and you can't read it, so I'm going to read it to you. Oh, Lord, I want to thank you that I was born in the West and not some other godforsaken place, and that I was able to become a Christian by default. I'm thankful that I don't have to think hard about what I believe. I can accept without a second thought anything that's fed to me, and that I can support the status quo with a clear conscience without interrupting my comfortable way of life. You've made me what I am today without any effort on my part. I haven't had to think, question, or change a thing. And for that, I am truly grateful. So back in the 60s, I hired this guy to be my spiritual teacher. And one of the first things he said to me was, my job is to knock you off the path. Your job is to get back on. That's where we learn. Doing wise and useful, effective spiritual work is a willingness to get knocked off the path. It's like getting an upgrade to your internal operating system. And part of that upgrade means being willing to subject yourself to a lifetime of continual upgrades. Now, the operating system we can so easily fall into, the one that uses those lines I mentioned earlier, it's just the way things are. You have to be realistic. You can't fight City Hall. These are part of what I have come to call the egoic operating system. Egoic operating system. And it's the one that we so easily fall into. One of the ways I understand the ritual of confession and worship is that it's from the divine calling for a system upgrade. And we're to get a system upgrade to the self-sacred operating system. So we go into the worship service or whatever ritual you create, and the call to us is repent. Change your mind. So that you can be aware that you are in sacred space. What's sacred space? Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart once said that he could not define pornography, but he knew it when he saw it. Reverence and sacred space are like that. They're difficult to define, but you know it when you're in it. The kind of awareness I'm talking about is what keeps people from trying to act like gods or God. We live in a culture that reveres money, power, education, religion. One of the first lessons given to the Hebrew people was, don't hold in reverence anything you can make with your hands. You know, don't make false idols. The God of Jesus falls into that category. You can't make God. We make religion, but you can't make God. Birth falls in that category. Sex does, death does, truth does, nature, art, justice, wisdom. I heard of a Native American spiritual teacher who says that he begins teaching people reverence by steering them toward the nearest tree and says, "Do you know you didn't make this?" And when they say yes, he knows they're on their way. It's not until we see ourselves truly that we can begin to see others reverently. I'm very suspicious of those religious folks who use their understanding of what is good as a warrant for proclaiming whole groups of people bad. So, I want to ask you a trick question. Where do you want to be in your life? The correct answer, as far as spiritual work is concerned, is here. Just here. I heard a recent interview with one of my spiritual heroes, Thich Nhat Hanh, and he was asked by the interviewer, Krista Tippett, and she said, "What is your current spiritual practice?" And he said, "My spiritual practice is being here." So the temple incident, whatever happened, was the equivalent of a Zen master clapping his hands or ringing the bowl. It served as a form of getting people's attention and calling them into the here and now. This moment. This moment right here is a precious moment. This moment has never been before. This moment. This moment will never be again. So our spiritual work is to notice how you are in this moment. So I'm going to give you an assignment this week. Okay? Go out for a walk, preferably where there are some people. Walk for a block and just pay attention. Just pay attention, that's all. You can even do it walking from here to the sanctuary across the way. Or just as you're milling around after class, just walk and notice. Notice the people and things that you're attracted to and those that you do like that to. Just notice. And you know what we're talking about is your prejudices. Right? There are people that say, "Oh, I'm not prejudiced." But just watch what you're attracted to and what you do that. Notice where your heart closes. And see if you can walk a block without your heart closing. You can't. But the goal, and I hope you don't ever mishear anything I say in here, is an encouragement for you to clean up your act. You can't do that. Just notice what your act is. Just notice. Pay attention. Pay attention. I came up with this exercise, and I couldn't get out of the car before I noticed, oop, right there. So, if you're not to clean up your act, what are you to do? Offer compassion to yourself for being the way you are. You cannot give others something you don't have. I heard a rabbi say one time that the Hebrew Scriptures contain the command to love your neighbor once. The same Scriptures command that we are to love the stranger 36 times. We first learn to love the stranger within, those denied, repressed, rejected aspects of ourselves, and then we offer what God has offered to us, to others. This is one of the primary goals of daily spiritual practice. Now, I think I have been guilty of making an assumption that may not be warranted for all of you, but I've gotten a couple of emails from people saying, what is a spiritual practice? That's a great question. So I'm going to tell you what my current understanding of a daily spiritual practice is. It'll be very brief. And I think now, as I see it, a daily spiritual practice consists of three things. First of all, it consists of learning. You read. You listen. You pay attention. You remember what our speaker, Paul Jones, said. I love that line from Carl Jung. If you don't say who you are, the world will tell you. So we have to be careful what we put into our hearts and minds. One of my clients brought to me this week a book that I had not seen called The Myth of Freedom. This is a Buddhist book. You could use this. You could read this. There are other books that you can get. This book, Always We Begin Again. This is a great book to read, just to read. So learning is something. Go to Richard Rohr's website, the Center for Action and Contemplation. Go to the bookstore. There are books, everything belongs. There are CDs by Jim Finley, by other people that you can listen to in your car. Spiritual practice involves learning, attending this, listening to Tommy. There are just all sorts of things. The second element of spiritual practice is contemplating. Now, I know that some of you who read and listen to people like Richard Rohr and Jim Finley and others know that they use a phrase called contemplative mind. I personally think that's confusing. Contemplative mind means something else. But contemplate on what you read. How does this fit me? You know, how am I utilizing in my living what I'm learning? If, for example, you hear a spiritual teacher say that there's something to be practiced in loving and welcoming the stranger, how's that going for you? And you review your life in light of that. You keep a journal. You wonder, what are my dreams telling me about my interior life that I'd rather not see? And again, this is not about cleaning up your act. This is about, not initially, it's about not being judgmental. It's about just noticing and accepting. And the third aspect of having a daily spiritual practice is learning to meditate. And I just pull some books off my... Look, you can go to Barnes & Noble and get Meditation for Dummies. I know you're not a dummy, but it has a lot of useful information in it. This is a book on Vipassana meditation. You know, some of you have heard that Sherry and I both did the 10-day, and some people in this class have done that. Phil Goldstein, a great Jewish Buddhist, wrote The Practice of Insight Meditation. And here's another one called The Art of Meditation. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. You can go online. You can find these resources that are out there. Meditating sometimes means just sitting down and shutting up and shutting out everything and counting your breath and noticing how far can you go in counting, say, to 10 that your mind doesn't go, phew. What's the energy in the oh, and you bring it back. Jack Kornfield, when I took some meditation training from him, said that you train your mind like you train a puppy to paper. You know, you don't beat the puppy. You just gently bring the puppy back, right? So, when Jack told me that, he's also Jewish and a psychologist and a Buddhist, one of the first Buddhist monks in America. When he taught me that, I was sitting there meditating and I thought, oh, good grief. My karma just ran over my dogma. Okay, and if you think I don't have time for meditation, I want to tell you. If you take time to meditate, you will have more time. And what I mean by that is that you will be less stressed. You will be more at peace. You will have a lighter heart. You will be happier. So, Jesus goes into the temple area. He does something. He says something. It marks the beginning of the end for him. What he taught was that by paying attention to what is really going on and who we really are, it's the end of life as we know it. But it's the beginning of the new life we are called to. No matter where you go this week, no matter what happens, remember this, you carry precious cargo, so watch your step, and I'll see you here next week. Thank you.